Today on the 21st Show, Margaret Sullivan was a newspaper editor, served as the reader representative at the New York Times, and then wrote about the media for the Washington Post. That last assignment was during the Trump era, and she now says some conventions of journalism are not up to the task of covering politicians who are essentially running against democracy itself. Sullivan's latest book is Newsroom Confidential: Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. This is a time of crisis for the press. Regional and local newspapers have seen precipitous drops in readership, brought on in part by rapacious private equity companies that are wringing every dollar from their investments as they're driving them to zero. But the problems go beyond that. There's also a crisis of trust in journalism across the American public. At the same time the media is in trouble, this is also a time of great peril for American democracy itself. An incredible number of candidates, Republican candidates, campaign not just for office, but against democracy itself. Journalists have been threatened. One was murdered last year in Nevada. And then there's this.
33% of the people in this country believe the fake news is, in fact, and I hate to say this, in fact, the enemy of the people.
The enemy of the people, a phrase that's found wide use among authoritarian regimes going back to the Stalin-era Soviet Union and earlier. And so today, we're revisiting my conversation with journalist Margaret Sullivan, who says American journalism and American democracy are inextricably intertwined. Sullivan was educated at Georgetown and then the Medill School at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. After that, she spent 3 decades at the Buffalo News, becoming chief editor there in 1999. Then she was public editor at the New York Times and a media columnist at the Washington Post. Now she's a visiting professor at Duke University. Her latest book, part memoir, part rallying cry for her profession, is Newsroom Confidential: Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. Writing in the New York Times Book Review, the veteran journalist and journalism educator Steve Call says, Sullivan remains the critic American journalism requires. A veteran practitioner with street cred, still in touch with the unaccountable joy of reporting and writing that continues to draw talented young people to the field. She's moved to outrage these days for the understandable reason that she wants the profession she loves to live up to its constitutional privileges at a time of democratic backsliding. Because our conversation is on tape, we're not taking calls live today, but you can always let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Okay, here now is my conversation with Margaret Sullivan. And I want to set aside the questions of the crisis we're in now and start with some of your personal story, because this is a memoir as well as a sort of polemical book about American journalism.
Yes, that's true.
And you begin your book, as you began your life, in Lackawanna, New York, outside Buffalo. And you say the Watergate hearings had a profound effect on you. And I want to begin with a clip from U.S. Representative Barbara Jordan. This is the first woman, the first African-American elected to Congress from Texas. Here she's talking about the eloquence of the phrase that opens the U.S. Constitution, we the people, and how she, as a black woman, had been excluded from that.
I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in We the People. Today, I am an inquisitor. And hyperbole would not be fictional and would not overstate the solemnness that I feel right now. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution.
All right, so the Watergate hearings were people not sitting by while the Constitution was subverted. Talk about the role of Watergate in your young life.
I love that clip from Barbara Jordan. What an inspiring figure. I mean, like a lot of American households in that era, my family was glued to the Watergate hearings. And, you know, my dad was a lawyer. I mean, we were in Lackawanna, a steel town. So lots of, you know, blue collar culture around us and everything. But my dad was a lawyer and my mom was a school teacher. And we were, you know, really riveted by this, you know, spectacle going on in Washington, D.C. And I got very interested in it myself, even though I was a pretty young teen. And I remember my eldest brother coming home from college, you know, and in sort of at the same time, all this Watergate stuff was happening. And David said to me, you know, what do you think you might like to do for a career? And I said, well, I don't really know. I like to write and I'm interested in what's going on and I'm interested in language, you know, something like that. And he pointed at me and he said, journalism. And, you know, it really was connected to the Washington Post's reporting, Woodward and Bernstein, All the President's Men and all of that. It was all of a piece with getting interested in journalism. And, you know, I've remained extremely kind of a bit of a student of Watergate. So it was definitely a seminal part of my upbringing.
I think you're, I know some women of that era, at least maybe 10 years earlier, who felt like their career choices were nurse or teacher.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I remember my, you know, very mixed messages coming about gender in that era. So, you know, I mean, I was in high school in the 70s and, you know, it was sort of like, yeah, you know, your brothers are going to absolutely need to have big careers, but you, we're not so sure about you. You know, the idea was, sure, do something, but you're probably going to get married and have kids, which I ultimately did do. But the emphasis was not on career or sort of that kind of growth. So, you know, there was something about the 70s in which, you know, second wave feminism was happening and the student protests of the Vietnam War, all this cultural turmoil, you know, it definitely affected me and is very much a part of who I am.
You know, it's hard, I think, for us to remember today, given the state of how media, people in the media are held among members of the public. But, you know, Watergate, the Pentagon Papers, other big stories of that era led the majority of Americans to respect reporters and people in the press, right?
Right. I mean, when I look back for the purposes of my book, Newsroom Confidential, you know, I looked back at the level of trust in the press in the 70s and sort of like the mid 70s, as you say, right after Watergate, right after the Pentagon Papers, the secret history of the Vietnam War had been leaked to the New York Times. Trust in the press was up in the mid 70s. You know, 70% of the population had a pretty good amount of trust in the press. And that has plummeted pretty steadily in the 50 years that followed. And you do have to put it in context a little bit, Brian, because trust in institutions generally has come down. So it's not just the media, but I think the media has had a particularly steep fall in the eyes of the public.
Arguably, the revelations of Watergate and the Pentagon Papers and Seymour Hersh and the CIA and everything else that was coming out of that era helped weaken trust in the press or trust in institutions, and that bled over into the press as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's kind of paradoxical. It's hard to track it exactly, but I do think, and I don't mean to be jumping ahead, but I do think that in more recent years, very recent years, you know, the disparagement of the press from the White House, the Trump White House, his campaign and then his White House, has definitely affected people. For some people, it's made the role of the press seem more crucial and more important and more necessary. But for a lot of people, it's sort of taught them or encouraged them to dislike and even hate the press.
Yeah. And I'm sure you have dealt with a lot more vitriol than I ever had to, given the public nature of your position and your gender and a lot of other factors.
But
we had a similar experience. I want to come back to it later, where people called us fake news to our faces.
Yes.
But I want to stay with your biography.
Always a lot of fun.
Yeah, all right. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with Margaret Sullivan, the author of Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. The book explores the relationship between the crisis in American journalism and that of American democracy. She also critiques the way journalism is done in America. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls. To let us know what you thought, send us an email, talk@21stshow.org, or leave a voicemail, 217-300-2121. And sticking with your rise in your career, you began going into newsroom management in your early 30s at the Buffalo mm-hmm. News. And you say you were leading a six-man politics and government team, emphasis on the men. And you write that it was stressful at times. The veteran politics reporter in particular didn't much like taking guidance from an editor barely in her 30s with much less experience than he had. That's one sentence in the book. I get the sense there's a lot of heartache or at least heartburn that's contained in there. Can you say more about that?
Well, I had been a reporter myself, and I think that I was considered a good reporter. So it wasn't like I was just some person off the street. But for these, you know, pretty grizzled reporters that might have been in their whatever, certainly well into middle age or older, who'd been doing the job for a long time, this was my first management job. So, you know, I was assigned this politics and government team, and it was all men. And I was probably just about 30 or maybe a tad over 30. And, you know, I had a pretty strong idea of how I wanted the coverage to be and how I wanted it to be more lively. And I wanted it to be somewhat more conversational. And, you know, they didn't always take to it really well. And I remember, I mean, one of the things I learned in management, and this has not too much to do with journalism, but maybe is a broader lesson, is that when you are a manager, you really need to be the grown-up in the room. And you cannot be getting mad or popping off or, you know, being impetuous, that you have to be the one who keeps your cool. And I probably learned that the hard way, not because I was running around castigating people, but just that when you did show some emotion or, you know, be critical publicly or something like that, you ended up having to apologize and backtrack and everything. And it was just much better to be mature to begin with. And, you know, there's nothing like real life to teach these lessons.
And you're in features when you're at the paper. And personally, as someone who spent and enjoyed time on the features side of a newspaper back in the day, I was A&E editor for the paper in Springfield, Illinois. Mm-hmm. How did you break out of that to rise and become the top editor?
Yes, well, you know, so after I was a hard news reporter, government reporter, education, business, all of that. But when I got my first big management job, it was as the assistant managing editor for features. And features, you know, is sort of considered the softer part of the paper. It's the culture coverage, it's the fashion coverage, it's the, you know, music, all that stuff, which I really, really enjoyed. But it didn't get as much respect internally as the city desk or as the investigative reporters or, you know, the national desk, that kind of thing. And I really had to swim against the tide as I tried to rise in the organization and tried to go for the next rung up, which was managing editor. And managing editor in Buffalo and in a lot of places is the number two job in the newsroom. So I wanted to be managing editor, but how could I be taken seriously when A, I was a relatively young woman, and B, I was in features, which is not, you know, kind of not considered the real deal. So, you know, how did I do it? I don't know. I always campaigned for these jobs that I wanted, and I would talk to the people above me and try to make the case and write a memo and, you know, be persuasive, which I think I am. And so I was able to sort of make the case that I would, in fact, do a good job.
That's a theme that comes up repeatedly in terms of this position, the positions we're talking about now. When you became public editor of the New York Times, you campaigned for that. It sounds like you were pretty aggressive in pursuing these promotions and new jobs.
Yeah,
is there
so.
Advice
I mean,
for young reporters?
I get bored with certain jobs, you know, and then I'm like, well, I really don't want to, you know, be the features editor of the Buffalo News for the rest of my life. So if I'm going to progress, I better make a case for it. So, you know, I don't apologize for having been, you know, forward thinking or ambitious, whatever the word might be, and going for these jobs, whether it was to become the top editor of the Buffalo News, or then after quite a few years, 12 years, I made a heavy duty case to move to New York City and take on this odd role of public editor at the Times.
And is there advice for young reporters with regard to that aggressiveness today? And I should say we need to take a break in about a minute here. But
I mean, I think that it's good to have. I mean, I always had a game plan, you know, what I wanted to be doing in a number of years, and I tried to progress in that direction. So I think it's good to be intentional about your career and your life, and to go for things that you want.
If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with Margaret Sullivan, the author of Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. The book explores the relationship between the crisis in American journalism and that of American democracy. She also critiques the way journalism is done in America. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls. Let us know what you thought. Send us an email, talk@21stshow.org, or leave a voicemail, 217-300-2121. All right, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, more of our conversation with Margaret Sullivan. Her book is Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're listening back to our conversation with former newspaper editor Margaret Sullivan about her book, Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. She writes that the conventions of journalism are not up to the task of covering politicians who are basically running against democracy itself. Because we're on tape today, we are not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing us. talk@21stshow.org is the address, talk@21stshow.org, or you can leave us a voicemail anytime, 217-300-2121, 217-300-2121. All right, more of our conversation with Margaret Sullivan. Again, the book is Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. Before we get into some of the critiques of American journalism and your ideas for what people should be doing differently in our profession, I do want to ask about your time at the New York Times and being the public editor there. Reading about that, I was reminded of this line from the late Christopher Hitchens, who once wrote that he invigorated himself every morning by checking the front page of the New York Times to see whether it still had that little box that says all the news that's fit to print, because the sort of arrogance and what he called censoriousness of it really enraged him and sort of invigorated him for the day. When you were public editor of the New York Times, walking into that newsroom to challenge your colleagues sometimes, what did you do to steel yourself?
Well, I mean, I had a lot of experience in journalism. I'd been in the business for quite a few years. I'd run a paper for 12 years, and I knew it was going to be really challenging, but I also felt I'm not sure why, but I felt pretty confident and able to rise to the challenge of being at this big, important institution and representing the readers. I think that's the thing that helped me the most, was the knowledge that I was there, you know, not to be bossy or to toss my opinion around, but to represent the readers of the New York Times who might have a problem with a story or a line of coverage or something like that. I was their representative inside the paper. And so I just tried to keep that in mind. And that helped me a lot.
Well, the New York Times, as well as many other national outlets, some people might say this about certain reporters at the Washington Post and Politico. One of the critiques you hear out there is that they're sticking with this idea in political journalism of having the view from nowhere. Can you talk about what is the view from nowhere?
Well, you know, that's an expression that has been sort of popularized by a professor, great thinker, I think, about the press, Jay Rosen at NYU, New York University. And what he means by that is that the view from nowhere is a kind of way of approaching journalism that suggests that the person who's writing the story or editing the story or the news organization has no worldview at all. It's just sort of serving as a megaphone or a stenographer for what's being said. And, you know, that's not actually realistic, because there's so many choices in journalism. Every headline, every photo choice, every news alert is done by human beings, and people bring their own, you know, sort of approach to it. So Jay's idea is to actually declare your biases up front and let people know where you're coming from, and then move forward from there.
What does that look like in practice? Is it like, you know, the little shirt tail, the tagline at the end of every story? You know, John Smith believes that life begins at conception and
right,
has been reporting
no.
for the paper
yeah,
for 10 years?
I don't think so. I think that that's going way too far. You know, we do want to be nonpartisan. We do want to be fair to everyone who we write about and interview. I think what that means is that we might say, what is our news organization all about? For example, ProPublica is oriented towards accountability journalism. This is what they're there for, is to do watchdog journalism in communities or in the country. And so it sort of declares that that's what they're all about. This is where we're going to be coming from. This is our mission. It's not really about, at least in my mind, it's not about carrying a picket sign and saying, I want this particular law changed, or I want this candidate elected. I don't actually think that's a good idea for journalists at all.
Okay, so ProPublica is an example of an outlet that's out there to like root out corruption, kind of be a watchdog. That's their ethos. We've had former U of I professor Nikki Usher on the show, and she had a book out, I think, last year called News for the Rich, White, and Blue. Broadly speaking, who do you think today's mainstream news is for?
Right. And I've read Nikki's book, and I know her, and her book is very interesting. You know, I mean, I've been at a bunch of different places, and I think that the people that we're trying to reach, I mean, it's not as if we're trying to reach just Democrats or just trying to reach rich people or white people. You know, the approach is that we're there for American citizens and not differentiating in terms of their color, their gender, their class in America. The idea is that we're there to inform the public, and without saying, beyond that, who it's for. I mean, I do understand that the news can be skewed in one direction or another, but that's not the intention, certainly.
If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with Margaret Sullivan, the author of Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. The book explores the relationship between the crisis in American journalism and that of American democracy. She also critiques the way journalism is done in America. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls. Let us know what you thought. Send us an email, talk@21stshow.org, or leave a voicemail, 217-300-2121. I do want to play a clip. You know, there's different visions of who the news and how the news should be tailored and who can be reached with news today. And this is from a panel discussion on the media from earlier this year. I heard it on Josh Barrow's podcast, Very Serious. But we're going to hear the Axios co-founder and CEO Jim Vandehei and what he had to say about how he wants his reporters to present the news.
We have a blanket prohibition that we try to enforce with anyone who works at our company from popping off ideologically on Twitter or in public forums. And almost always our staff sticks to it. And the reason I say that we should do that is we want to try to earn the trust of the persuadables. Listen, QAnon, and like we've always had nut jobs in our world, and we just didn't obsess about them the way we do right now. And you're not going to persuade them, but there are persuadable people if you can do really high quality journalism without always having to put your finger on the scale.
What do you think of that?
I mean, I essentially agree with that straight ahead news reporters should not be expressing their partisan views, whether on social media or in their stories. I mean, I think where it gets a little bit more nuanced and more of a gray area is, you know, how about civil rights? How about, equal rights? What about human rights in general? Are we okay? What about press rights? Is it okay for journalists to stand up for free speech? You know, I think there are things that are so foundational to the country we live in that journalists should be comfortable, talking about those things pretty forthrightly. But I don't think they should take on partisan causes. And sometimes that's a fine line.
It's a fine line because sometimes the truth, which I think most journalists would say they stand up for, becomes itself an issue of partisan dispute, right?
It certainly has been in recent years. I mean, I think that when we saw what happened on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, I mean, the people who showed up there and in many cases were violent and had an idea of turning over the election, you know, they had been steeped in false information and they chose to believe it and they didn't really check it out or bother to find out that those things weren't true. So there is truth. There is such a thing as truth, but we don't necessarily have in our country anymore a common foundation of truth or kind of a common reality that we all agree upon.
If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation with Margaret Sullivan, the author of Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. The book explores the relationship between the crisis in American journalism and that of American democracy. She also critiques the way journalism is done in America. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls. Let us know what you thought. Send us an email, talk@21stshow.org, or leave a voicemail, 217-300-2121. Steve is calling from Chicago. Steve, you're on with Margaret Sullivan. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you so much. Enjoying the conversation quite a bit. As an aside, my youngest daughter graduated this summer from the Medill School of Journalism, so we'll see where she goes with that.
Congratulations.
All right.
I wanted to ask your guests, just as an observation, with regards to the 2016 election, number one, what do you think was Rupert Murdoch's agenda outside of making a lot of money? And do you think Fox Media, and for that matter, maybe some press, have blood on their hands for giving Donald Trump such free ride leading up to the 2016 election? Somebody said that they thought he got like $1 billion worth of free press from Fox News, which really makes me wonder, well, what exactly is their agenda? And now it seems, the horse has left the barn and we're stuck with the mess that we're currently in. And so much of it to me is the way it seemed the press did or did not cover Donald Trump. And I mean, I know it's like a moth in a flame analogy, but I was just wondering your guest comment, and I'll ring off and listen. Thank
All
you
right.
so much.
Thanks, Steve.
So, great question. There's a lot there. And you know, I take up a lot of these issues in the book at some length, but I do think that, corporate media in general, and most media these days is owned by corporations. They have a profit motive. There's no question about that. They are not public radio. You know, they're not the local guy who's putting out a weekly newspaper for fun. They are trying to make money. They are trying to report to their shareholders and so on. But the way that Fox has gone about it is often pretty unhinged from reality and sometimes not infrequently irresponsible. So I do think that, they gave actually all news media gave Trump a tremendous amount of free free media during the campaign. I mean, they're famously, there were shots of the empty podium, you know, at a rally or whatever it was he was doing, just waiting for him to come. Why? Because he is compelling to watch. I mean, you may or may not like him, but there's something about Trump that does capture your attention. And he himself has called himself a ratings machine. And while he does utter a lot of falsehoods and lies, that's not one of them. He is a ratings machine. But I think it was irresponsible. And it you know, it absolutely helped him in the 2016 campaign. And another thing that helped him in the 2016 campaign was the media's unbelievable interest and inability to let go of Hillary Clinton's email scandal, if you want to call it a scandal, the emphasis on it and the unending nature of it, you know, constantly on front pages, constantly at the top of broadcasts. I mean, it really definitely had an effect on her. Sometimes, in some cases, it just caused people to stay home because they, from voting, because they threw up their hands and said, I don't like either one of these candidates. Whereas the coverage of Trump was, I think, more just sort of wide-eyed, like, wow, isn't this crazy? And so, yes, I think the media did a lot that helped Trump and hurt Clinton.
The Clinton emails, that's, do you see that as an instance of reporters covering themselves from accusations of bias by maybe going hard at Democratic candidates where they can?
You know, I've looked at this a lot, and I think the coverage was definitely overkill. You know, it's speculation why it was like that. My own theory, and this is based on having been at the New York Times during much of that, is that the Times sort of felt like she was going to be the president, that she was going not only going to be the Democratic nominee, but most likely she was going to be the president. So there was an effort to sort of say, well, okay, she's going to be the president, but we're going to be able to say that we, and feel that we really, you know, scrubbed her background. We really were not easy on her. We were tough on her, but she's going to win anyway. I mean, that was sort of the thinking. And a lot of people were surprised on election night 2016. I mean, I was in the Washington Post newsroom by then, and I was surprised, and so were most of my colleagues, and so were journalists all over the country. So we did not see that coming.
Yes, I remember where I was that night as well, as my yes. colleague, who is generally very healthy, was eating fistfuls of cheese puffs. just because it was going to be an interesting ride, we knew, for the years ahead. All right, let's see if we can get in one more caller before the break. We've got about 2 minutes. Barb is on line one from Danville with a question about the fairness doctrine. Barb, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for your show. It seems like there used to be something called the fairness doctrine, where if one side was presented, the other side had to get equal time. And then that disappeared at some point, and I don't know if that was a congressional thing or what it was, but would that reinstating that help restore the more focus on truth and all sides of an issue?
All right. Thanks for the question, Barb.
Right. So, you know, I think the fairness doctrine might be a little bit outdated today because of, you know, the kind of news environment we're in which news is coming at us from all directions. It's not just, you know, the three broadcast networks. And I also, you know, I'm not sure that taking things down the middle makes a lot of sense when one side is spewing falsehoods. For example, the number of election denialists, I mean, do we really want to give them equal time to spew a lot of things that aren't correct? So I do worry about trust in the news media. I do worry about the accusations of bias, but I don't think that the fairness doctrine is the answer to today's problems.
Yeah, and just to build on what you were saying, and we need to take a break here, but I mean, I think the fairness doctrine was rooted in the fact that the Federal Communications Commission regulated the airwaves, and so little of the news today is actually received over the airwaves. It's cable and smartphones and every other method of distribution we have. All right, we need to take another quick break. When we come back, the conclusion of our conversation with Margaret Sullivan. Her book is Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. All today, we're revisiting my conversation with Erin Kuei-Nin, who's the author of Passing for Perfect, College Imposters, and Other Model Minorities. She's also on the faculty at UC Santa Barbara, where she's in the Department of Asian American Studies, associate professor there. The book is about a very small number of students who go to extreme lengths to perform the role of being good students that they feel their culture and society expects of them. We also talked about this with Nia Lay, who's a clinical social worker and therapist who helps people cope with pressures and questions around their culture and identity, and Raina Wu, who is studying computer science and philosophy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Raina, I wonder, to the extent you're comfortable talking about it, if you can talk about your own, you know, family experience and, you know, how that, you mentioned earlier that maybe you didn't feel quite as much pressure as Professor Nin was describing a little bit earlier before the break.
Yeah, I think that that kind of external pressure wasn't as much present in my family. I think my parents have constantly encouraged me to seek help when needed, and you know, it's okay to fail, it's okay to make mistakes. But even if it's even with that external validation, internally it's like very easy to invalidate my own feelings. And like, you know, given such great opportunities and like being in a place of privilege, like things should, I sometimes it feels like things should be fine, and but and like the academic and social pressures start to take precedence of like what I know is like rationally true and what is being told to me. So I think I know that dynamic is not as common in a lot of Asian American families, but yeah, in my personal experience, there's just a bit of a disconnect between, you know, those external and internal kind of feelings.
All right. At this point, I want to. We also got a voicemail that I want to listen to now that's talking about some of these topics. So let's listen to that.
My name is Darren Biscup, and I'm 20 years old. I didn't hear the term like model minority until it came from someone who wasn't Asian. I don't think it's the top concern of a lot of Asians, and yet it's like, I didn't know that was how we were viewed. You know, most of the pressure is probably coming from our own families rather than people who might consider us a model minority. But so yeah, is there pressure to be perfect? I think it has a lot to do with school. Our parents, they view education as such a consistent path to success, or such a stable path to success out of all the other paths that exist. The decision by my mom to like pursue greater education was probably like the best return on investment decision she might have made. So she grew up in Taiwan. She got her undergrad degree in Taiwan, and she was working in Taiwan up till she was like 30. She was doing some kind of like sales type of work, and she decided that she wanted to pivot her entire career in a completely opposite direction. And so she came to the United States and started learning computer science at a CSU. That decision led to her getting a job in computer science, or like as an engineer, and then everything went up from there. I more and more kind of like align with my mom's stance on education, which is kind of funny because back when I was applying to college, there was tons of friction with my mom just on what to study or like what I wanted to get out of college. But yeah, it's totally changed now that I'm actually in college.
All right. Thank you, Darren, for sharing that with us. And Raina, thank you as well. And Professor Nin, let me ask you, though. So though we just heard two perspectives who maybe had, you know, more positive familial or feelings about, you know, their family's orientation toward educational achievement and success. But it's certainly not universal. And it's not the subject of what you've been writing about or what you wrote about in your book. So can you talk about a little, let's maybe talk about another individual that you profiled, Jennifer Pan.
So Jennifer grew up in Toronto, Canada, And she was groomed from an early age to be a kind of trophy child. So her parents had her, competing in ice skating with hopes for the Olympics. They also had her in a music conservatory learning piano. And she was performing both to such high levels that, you know, her teachers would say, it's rare to see anybody doing this well. So yeah, right. And neither of these were her own choices of pursuit. Neither was the goal of her becoming a pharmacologist. So these were all her father's selections, but she was such a good kid, you know, and she really strove to meet these goals that he had set. And then something went a little bit awry in at the end of middle school graduation. I think it's so minor. The amazing thing is how minor this is. She fully expected, because her grades seemed to, you know, make it natural that she would become valedictorian, she would get all these awards, neither of which happened. And I think something started to crack in her belief in the system of meritocracy. So beginning in high school, she started to pass, you know, to pretend to still be this perfect child. In the meantime, some of her grades were slipping. By the end of high school, she failed one calculus final, and that one calculus final meant that she did not have all the full credits to get her high school diploma. But instead of being able to tell her parents that she did not have that diploma, needed to take summer school, that was the point where she went big, you know, and pretended everything was fine and started, you know, the charade of attending a college to which her admission had been rescinded.
Wow. Is she the one who ultimately hires somebody to murder her parents?
Yes, yes. Yeah. So they, this went on for like 5 years, all through what would have been undergrad and part of what would have been her pharmacology program. And in the meantime, you know, she did have a secret boyfriend, but she was also living a very conservative lifestyle, really. You know, she had a part-time job in a pizza parlor where she was a really good manager, you know, that kind of thing, or a server, sorry. And then her parents found out that she had in fact been lying to them. They didn't find out about the high school thing, but they did find out that she was not actually in college. And so they clamped down and reasserted a strict curfew. But by now she was in her mid to late 20s. And she tried once again to kind of get back on track. And she also tried to kill herself, I think, a couple times. But neither of those courses worked. And so in her mind, the calculation, you know, like she could not see an option where she just rebelled or simply flat out disappointed them and still managed to live a happy life. And so in her calculus, it was somehow better. If her parents could die with whatever illusion was left, you know, of their daughter being able to meet their expectations, right?
Wow.
And then she would be free. But only under those circumstances could she imagine being free.
Niele, you've been listening to this. I wonder what your response is. You know, what are you thinking when you hear that story?
I think it just saddens me to know that. I think the myth part of the model minority, kind of like you were all alluding to earlier, is that there is no end to it, right? It's something that it's not something that we can, the myth portion is like nothing that we can achieve. And it's oftentimes I see with clients that it it is kind of a human experience, right? To feel less than, to feel inadequate, to feel not enough. And unfortunately for with the model minority, it's just there's a clear source to what makes some of us feel this way. And helping clients to feel enough, to feel themselves, or in kind of the micro lens, hopefully can help one individual to feel that they don't need to hide some of that stuff, that they can be themselves and not resort to some extreme measures sometimes.
And can you talk a little bit, as what we were talking about before the break, about, you know, the idea of helping individuals, but then this really also in some ways shouldn't be on the individual, right? It should be a more broadly through the culture or the society, something that we address. Where do you come down on that balance?
Well, as a micro practitioner, I'm very on the one-on-one lens. Definitely there's lots of things systemically that need to happen to help with the micro, right? Access to care, destigmatizing care, quality, increasing quality of care. But it's, I guess, so for me to speak more on the micro, because that's where my experience is helping clients to find and define themselves a little bit more, and including the values of society, right? It's not to say that we don't have some of the same values as society, as our cultures, but to help us find that balance, to find that integration that makes sense for us. And that's gonna be very different for every individual, and helping them find that point so they can feel at peace in their own bodies, in their own minds, in their own hearts. And whatever proportions that is, that includes some of these external and internal things.
All right, Neil A., I know you need to run before the end of the hour, so I want to thank you so much for being with us. He's a clinical social worker and therapist who helps people cope with these pressures around their culture and identity. Thank you for joining us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Nin, I want to come back to you as we're approaching the end of our conversation. And as we talked about earlier, and I think it bears repeating, you intentionally chose these cases because in some ways they are very extreme and interesting, frankly, representations. You wrote your book wanting it to be accessible to students. What do you hope that young people take away from it?
Well, both the sense that, you know, how devastating this path they're on can end up being, but also a kind of corollary of that is a sense of recognition that these cases, these outlier cases, are actually not that different from you know, our own motivations as second generation Asian Americans, you know, trying to please everyone in our lives, right, on the macro and the micro level. So these are cautionary tales that I'm presenting, and also I'm hoping to allow readers to take some pause, you know, and imagine alternatives to what seem to be, you know, a path of no felt options. You either succeed, or I mean, the alternative to success is just annihilation, right? It's not fathomable, to live with failure. And I am hoping very hard that the book helps people to reframe that for themselves.
Erin Kuei-Nin is associate professor at UC Santa Barbara and the author of the book, Passing for Perfect, College Imposters and Other Model Minorities. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st
Show. Thank you so much for having me.
Raina Wu, we've also been speaking with, is a student in computer science and philosophy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Raina, thank you for coming in and sharing your own personal experience as well. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was my conversation with Erin Kuei-Nin, Nia Lei, and Raina Wu about the myth of the model minority and some of the pressures that come with that. You can stay up to date with us online. We are on Facebook. Just search for The 21st. You can also leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or find any of our other social media sites. It's all linked on our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past segments there, or you can just find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify and Apple. Just search for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Owen Henderson. Our conversation today was originally produced by Erica Scalise and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.